All right, so my guest today is Miles Brundage. Miles is a research fellow at the University of Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute and a PhD candidate in Human and Social Dimensions of Science and Technology at Arizona State University. He is affiliated with the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes, the Virtual Institute of Responsible Innovation, and the Journal of Responsible Innovation. His research focuses broadly on the societal impacts of artificial intelligence, and today we're going to be talking about the case for conditional optimism about AI. Welcome to the show, Miles.
Thanks for having me.
So, Miles, I'm glad you could join me for this conversation because we're going to be taking a deep dive into some of the arguments and ideas in a paper you've recently written called Scaling Up Humanity, the Case for Conditional Optimism About AI. Now, this paper isn't currently available for public consumption, but it was the subject matter of a talk you delivered to the EU Parliament back in October, I think, a video of which is available online and which I'll provide a link to. So maybe you could actually just start by telling us about that event and what was the intention and purpose behind it.
Yeah, so this was an event organized by the STOA panel, the Science and Technology Options Assessment panel, which is part of the European Parliament. And they organized an event a few months back, broadly looking at recent discussions about risks from AI and presenting a variety of perspectives, some more focused on the potential catastrophic risks associated with AI, represented, for example, by Ola Hagström, who works on existential risk-related issues, as well as more optimistic takes, such as represented by Steven Pinker, who presented a general overview of arguments for optimism about the future of humanity in light of empirical trends towards reduced violence and other positive things. So my take on this was that the upside of AI is potentially enormous, but given that I work on issues such as the malicious uses of AI, as well as potential risks from arms races around AI, the case was very conditional. So that's how the title for the paper came about, the case for conditional optimism. And so I was trying to present sort of a moderate take on these issues, and the event ended up organizing an edited volume. So that's where the written form of the paper came about, and that should be published sometime in a month or so.
So was this paper born out of a certain maybe frustration with the tendency of discussions around AI to always harp on the negative aspects of it, and that there was a need for a positive case?
Yeah, it was partly that, and it was partly that the level of detail. So I think there's been a lot of detailed discussion of the negative aspects of things, and but the longer term benefits of AI have often either been very glibly mentioned or they've been sort of not argued for in a very explicit way. So, for example, people talk about the potentially huge health benefits of AI, or that it could that it could eliminate poverty, but there hasn't been sort of a systematic case for why exactly AI could do those things, other than, you know, intelligence is the source of all of society's strengths or something fairly vague like that. So I tried to break that argument down into more manageable chunks that could be examined or refuted in more depth.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that Steven Pinker and Ola Hagström participated in this event. Who else was on the panel? How many of you were there?
So it was us and then Peter Bentley, and then there were a few folks, there were a few members of European Parliament that were also included.
Okay, so we might come back to the reaction to this later, but I'm just curious initially, like, what were the kind of perspectives from people from the European Parliament? Were they neutral, or were they positive or negative? What was the ethos behind their comments?
Yeah, I mean, my general impression from attending EP events has been that they are largely focused on the economic implications of AI. This is perhaps overly simplifying, but certainly there's a lot of concern in the EU about job displacement as well as economic productivity upsides associated with AI. So I would say that they tended to focus more on those sorts of issues compared to, you know, some of the more abstract and long-term things that I discuss in the paper, which is sort of a, you know, leisure society over the long term and greater coordination across time scales and physical scales, which I think are potential upsides of AI, but perhaps not as connected to the day-to-day concerns of an EP member.
Okay, so, I mean, let's try and get into your argument a bit then. Sure. So obviously the focus of this conversation is on artificial intelligence, and you know, I'm sure people have an intuitive sense of what that means, or a sense from what they've read in popular media or seen in films and so forth. But I think it's important that we have some clear enough definitions in mind at the outset so that we can appreciate the argument that you're offering. So, you know, what do you mean by artificial intelligence? How do you define that concept or term?
Sure. So I think there are a lot of different definitions of AI, and one useful taxonomy comes from the Russell and Norvig textbook on this topic. So Artificial Intelligence, a Modern Approach. And they distinguish between whether one thinks of AI in terms of the thought process, so you know, rational thinking or human-like thinking, and whether you look at the outcome, so rational behavior, human-like behavior, and then as suggested by the distinction between human-like and rational, one can either focus on whether you're trying to emulate the precise mechanics and gestalt of a human in order to pass as human or to better understand human behavior, or whether you're just trying to make good decisions in a wide range of environments. And I tend to focus on a definition of AI that focuses on the rational behavior side of things. So that's not the only approach. A lot of people look at AI in a lot of different ways. But from my perspective, AI is largely about trying to use digital technology to create systems that can perform a wide range of tasks. Those tasks are commonly thought to require intelligence when they're done by a human or by a non-human animal. So it's not just performing the same task over and over. There's some learning or some adaptation of exactly what is being performed in the task, depending on changes in the environment or different opportunities. So there's a bit of a trouble with defining AI in terms of any individual task because there's this what's known as the AI effect, wherein any time that something is actually solved by the field of AI, that people no longer consider it AI. That, you know, happened with chess, for example, where while I think there's a case to be made that depended on a lot of advances in AI and search algorithms, for example, once it happened, people were less impressed and they decided that chess was actually easy after all, although now people are talking about AlphaZero as something that was impressive. So the goalposts shift over time, but I think AI is characterized by focusing on the general problem of finding solutions to task either offline or online, as in when you're presented with the task for the first time, and trying to gradually broaden the range of tasks that can be performed by the same system or by a suite of different systems.
Yeah, so I mean, you're not so focused on the idea of human likeness, you're focusing on just, you know, rational problem solving, so to speak. I mean, another distinction that's drawn out in the literature is that between narrow and more general or broader forms of AI. I mean, how important is that distinction in your discussion of this topic?
So there are a couple things going on. One is that it's potentially more transformative for society if the same system can perform a wide range of tasks without additional human input, because then that allows for more application to different problems. It requires less human expertise in order to get the same output, because you don't just need a bunch of AI experts to be applying AI experts or domain experts to be applying these systems to different problems. But also is potentially the case that you need some generality, some common sense, some transfer learning, as it's often called in AI, in order to bring to bear the lessons learned from one domain onto another domain. And there are arguments to the effect that you're never actually going to solve certain forms of dialogue or high-level planning in domains that have hierarchies of time scales without some degree of generality. But I think that's largely an empirical question. So it's often the case that things that we thought of as AI complete or the sorts of things that you would need to solve all of AI in order to do end up being somewhat easier than we thought with relatively narrow systems. So things like video understanding or video captioning and image recognition and Go are things that turned out to be fairly solvable with relatively narrow systems. But I think the techniques that we're using in order to solve even relatively narrow problems are gradually getting a bit broader in themselves over time, by which I mean we're starting to be able to apply systems with relatively small modifications to a wide range of problems. So in that sense, we're making a bit more progress towards generality. So AlphaZero, for example, required relatively small changes of the inputs, the degree to which it explored different actions in order to be applied to the games of Go, Shogi, and chess, compared previously to systems that were much more specialized to those tasks. And similarly, in the case of Atari games, there have been systems that have been applied to up to around 57 different games with no changes at all. So with the same exact inputs of just receiving the pixels on the screen, and they've achieved pretty good performance. So we're making some progress in terms of applying the same system or very similar versions of a system to a wide range of tasks, but what's really challenging and hasn't yet been decisively demonstrated and has a lot of people excited in the field is having a single system that can learn a bunch of different tasks and remember how to achieve each of those tasks. So there's no what's called catastrophic forgetting. As it learns a new task, it forgets how to do the old one. And that's a potentially transformative capability in terms of the applications it'll unlock, but that still has not been done in a super impressive way.
Yeah, so I mean the kind of gold standard here is something like the master algorithm that Dominguez talks about in his book with that title. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of mentioned this already, but you know, you keep up to date a lot with the developments in AI, and if anyone follows you on Twitter, they'll know that you regularly link to papers with the latest discoveries. So what do you think of as the most exciting developments in this area? I mean, from my perspective, there seems to be a lot of hype to an extent around AI, a lot of public conversation and discussion about it. But is this hype well-founded? Are there really groundbreaking developments taking place?
There is a lot of hype for sure, and there are tons and tons of startups as well as big companies that are rushing into AI, and there's a lot of incentive these days to hire AI researchers or to brand oneself as an AI company, even if one is just doing fairly basic statistics. So there's definitely hype going on, but I think there is some basis for it in that AI systems are actually being applied in real systems that are producing value for companies and for end users in a way that is more the case than in, say, the big wave of hype in the 80s when there was a lot of excitement around expert systems, but not a ton of that was actually realized on technologies that impacted millions of people's lives. So I think it's the case that AI is already affecting billions of people's lives. So there's a basis in that for things like machine translation, some aspects of search engines, speech recognition, mapping algorithms, and all sorts of other things. AI is already being deployed, and small changes to the performance, or especially big changes to the performance of these systems on any of those tasks, are producing a lot of value for companies. So there's a huge incentive to keep investing in this area. And even outside of those commercial domains, there's increasing attention to things like AI for cybersecurity defense and AI in the military. So I think it makes a lot of sense for companies and researchers and governments to be talking a lot about AI, and how they talk about it and how much they hype, overhype or underhype it is, a separate discussion. But I think there is something there.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of alluded to the previous AI winters in the past, periods of apparently no real progress or development in the field. I've read a couple of articles recently, and these are articles that I may have read more by headline than by content, which are suggesting that we might be on a brink of a new AI winter. I mean, do you put any credence in that? Do you think that's a possibility that, you know, we're a lot of developments at the moment, but maybe there's no systematic breakthrough. We're still relying on basic machine learning principles that were discovered in the 80s.
I could imagine a big shakeup, you know, a lot of startups dying and a lot of big companies sort of scaling back their resources. But I would be very surprised to see companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon, who have AI involved in a wide range of systems and have a lot of money to keep investing in research, if they were to scale back significantly, I would be surprised. And there's also a lot of inertia in the system. So there are governments pouring a lot of money into this, and even before the recent wave of excitement, there was, you know, sustained funding by government agencies like NSF in the U.S. and DOD, that, you know, they might scale things back a little bit, and there are some signs that NSF is scaling back a little bit, but I would be surprised if it was just a total collapse. And there's a lot of excitement, and I think people find a fair amount of money one way or the other to keep doing basic research. But certainly, I could imagine a lot of startups not panning out. And I mean, I guess that's sort of the baseline assumption in most industries anyway. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's speculation and we don't know for sure what'll happen. But I tend to agree that it would be surprising if the whole thing unraveled. Now, let's get into the actual argument itself then. So you're making a case for conditional optimism about artificial intelligence, but that obviously raises the question of, like, conditional upon what? What's the assumption that you're bracketing for the purposes of this argument?
Sure. So I think there are a number of reasons why we might not achieve the positive outcomes that I think are theoretically possible with AI. There are, very broadly, one could characterize this as issues related to misuse and issues related to accidents. So people could use AI for malicious purposes. There could be use of AI to strengthen authoritarian states at a local level or even an international level in some very bad scenarios. And there could be catastrophic accidents. So ones related to issues that I mentioned a minute ago, like AI applied to cybersecurity, if that could get out of control in various harmful ways, or if AI systems were truly superhuman in their intelligence and were able to circumvent human controls, then that could lead to other sorts of potentially world-ending scenarios, as discussed in Nick Bostrom's book Superintelligence. So I think, you know, the downsides are potentially very large. But I don't think any of those are. And another distinction I'll make is between sort of political and technical, you know, reasons, conditions for success. So one can think in terms of misuse and accidents, and one can also think in terms of technical issues, like we just didn't put enough thought into safety, and it turned out by the time we had general AI, we just weren't prepared for it. Or it could be political problems. So we could have done this in principle, but there was too much squabbling, and the right people weren't in the right place at the right time, or bad people became in charge of big AI projects, and so forth. So I think there are ways in which that could not happen. But for the purpose of this paper, I think it's important to look at both sides of the cost-benefit ledger. And as I was saying earlier, there's recently been a lot of discussion of the negative side, and I wanted to say, okay, if we solve the misuse problem and the accident problem and the political problems and the technical problems, then what could the upside be?
Yeah, so this makes me wonder then, I mean, those are some fairly significant impediments or obstacles to the optimistic or positive use of AI. So I'm just wondering how strong an argument you see this as being. I mean, how optimistic should we be? Or is that a question that you're just not really even getting into?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't, the title of the paper is somewhat cheeky because, conditional optimism might be a misnomer, as optimism and pessimism are often thought of as sort of attitudinal states or expectations, as opposed to just, theoretical arguments. And this is more of a theoretical paper. It's not that I'm not assigning any particular probability to the positive scenarios. So, I think it's potentially a misnomer, but I think the way that I think about it is I'm trying to flesh out the sort of optimistic scenario that one could have in one's head. So if one thinks in terms of a distribution over positive and negative and more mixed scenarios, I'm sort of making the case for why the more optimistic side of things is actually really, really good. So I think it's sort of, you know, I'm trying to beefen up and flesh out the optimistic end of scenarios for when people are thinking in terms of, well, why should we even build AI to begin with?
Yeah, and I mean, I think there is value to that, even if it is conditional upon some other factors, because as you pointed out, you know, oftentimes the positive or optimistic case for AI is very vague. You know, people talk generally about ways in which AI could enhance well-being or improve safety, but they're not overly specific about that, except maybe in some instances where they'll say, like, you know, self-driving cars will reduce the number of accidents.
Yeah. So the case for optimism is often either vague or it's very near-term oriented. So while people talk about long-term negative risks, they often only talk very vaguely about leisure society and don't explain exactly how we get there, why it's connected to AI, or why we couldn't do it through other mechanisms. Just to give some examples, there's a lot of talk about driverless cars, as you said, but also in cases like healthcare, there's a lot of focus on, you know, the next cool technical problem or the next exciting social application of AI, but it's usually things that are just over the horizon, or I guess, like, you know, on the horizon that are visible, as opposed to things that are well over the horizon. So things like neural networks for interpreting X-rays, or sort of, you know, note taking for doctors, which I think are potentially very useful, but also not quite as extreme in their implications as, you know, fully automated AI doctors or, you know, solving aging. So I think, you know, those more outlandish things are understandably not the sorts of things that people who are in the trenches are, you know, promising as immediate applications of AI. And perhaps they'll never be realized, but I think for the purpose of, you know, a cost-benefit analysis of the technology for civilization as a whole, it's good to know whether there's actually potentially something there.
Yeah, so you're really focusing more on identifying the mechanisms through which AI can more generally realize positive states of existence for humanity. Now, you have three arguments in the paper, so three mechanisms through which AI can achieve these positive outcomes. And let's go through them one by one. And the first one really is about task expedition. So you think that it's a positive thing to create AI because it can expedite tasks. Could you maybe flesh that argument out a little bit and perhaps give an example of how this works?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just say something about the properties of AI as a technology. So I think in the paper, I talk about three things. So I talk about three mechanisms for getting to positive outcomes. So as you mentioned, there's task expedition, and there's also improved coordination and leisure society. But they share a common feature, which is that they're the result of scalable competence. So what I mean by that is that AI uniquely among technologies combines the scalability of digital technologies with the flexibility of human competence. So when you have the ability to copy things and run them really fast on digital systems, that gives you scalability. And when you have learning and adaptation and in more distant developments in AI, common sense reasoning, and when you put those two things together, you have scalable competence. And never before has humanity really had that, because there's, at any given time, a fixed number of humans that can be carrying out tasks, and there are limits to how much we can think, and we can't just create copies of ourselves instantly in the same way that we can do that with digital computers. So those are sort of the like underlying mechanisms that feed into the point about task expedition. To dive into task expedition, basically what I mean is that there are a large number of tasks in the world that either humans are able to do with enough time, but society hasn't allocated enough resources to them, or there's a serial element to that where one thing has to be done before another thing can be done, and it just would take us, you know, many decades or centuries to achieve this task. So maybe like colonization of Mars is something like that, that, you know, Elon Musk and others are excited about, but is, you know, undoubtedly requires many steps in series where you have to build the rockets and get the people there and set up the cities and all that. And so, and there are also tasks that humans would never be able to do just because we're not smart enough, or we have limitations on our short-term and long-term memory, and we can't just read all of the scientific literature and remember all of it and piece all the and bring all the pieces together in our head simultaneously. Whereas in principle, if you solved a lot of aspects of AI, then AI systems could potentially do that. So the idea behind Task Expedition is that we can more quickly reach the limits of what's physically possible, which I assume to be the upper bound on what is achievable by, you know, physical systems. We can more quickly reach that asymptote if we're able to scale up the number and quality of cognitive systems applied to a certain task. So that potentially includes producing a bunch of copies of AI systems and running them in simulation to coordinate with one another and perform scientific research, or it might include producing a bunch of copies of robots to increase economic growth because then they can, you know, create factories and produce goods and services, or it might include running systems much faster. Instead of just making AI systems more numerous, it can involve making them think faster, and it might involve increasing the intelligence of these systems. So it's often the case that while the returns aren't always linear, one can get better performance out of AI systems by throwing more compute at them. So Task Expedition is essentially what I'm arguing comes from combining scalable competence with problems that we want to solve.
Okay, so for like any general problems that we have that just require an input of resources and time, AI can help us to solve those problems by expediting the achievement of the goal or the resolution of the problem in some way. I mean, just to give an example here, which I happen to have in front of me because I was writing about it earlier on. This is a calculation from a book by Daniel and Richard Susskind about the future of the professions, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but they talk about doctors and medical diagnosis and figuring out like what the optimum treatment for a patient is. And they calculate that a new medical paper is published on average every 41 seconds. And if only 2% of those studies were relevant to the average medical practitioner, they would still have to read for 21 hours every day just to keep up with the ongoing growth and kind of scientific knowledge. Well, one thing that AI can do is it can actually keep up with the field in a way that humans could never do. And that's partly through the expedition of the processing of information and the processing of knowledge. So, I mean, that's one concrete illustration of it.
Yeah, so I think we already have digital systems that are augmenting human thinking in a wide range of domains. So, just to give one AI-specific example, there's this Twitter bot called Brundage Bot that someone created of me, and because I tweet about a lot of papers, and it essentially takes the same input that I was using, which is a bunch of papers and their titles and their abstracts, and it was trying to guess based on my track record, like what are the papers that Miles would have tweeted. And I've actually found that to save me some time. It doesn't get everything perfect, and there's some ways in which I kind of have to, you know, oversee it. But certainly there are all sorts of ways in which one can cleverly apply technology, and already things like search engines and Google Scholar are very helpful for expediting scientific research. But there are limits. So I think if one had AI systems that could actually read all those papers and actually understand them, or even maybe not quite at the level of a trained scientist, but maybe at the, you know, undergrad level where they can do like semi-superficial lit reviews, that could be super helpful. And I think, the limit is, you know, there's a very high upper limit on how much this could accelerate scientific research. I mean, in the extreme case, AI systems could just do all the scientific research, but I don't think you have to get to that point in order for there to be a big impact of Task Expedition. So I think it's somewhat analogous, and as you know, because we wrote wrote an article about this together a while back on cognitive scarcity and AI. I think that AI be a lot like personal assistants in that it could free up the bandwidth of people to focus on what they want to focus on, and could be a lot like people who have a big staff of assistants or schedulers or chiefs of staff that are sort of working in the background to make things go more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, so full disclosure, myself and Miles have worked together in the past, just in case people are wondering when they're listening. So the idea is that this mechanism is generalizable to a lot of different domains, and I mean, that sounds plausible to me. But I mean, I also see some negatives and downsides to task expedition in certain contexts. And in fact, you know, one of your colleagues from the Future of Humanity Institute, Andrew Sandberg, was on this podcast before talking about speed and computation. And while he identified many positive upsides to faster computation, he also recognized that there are some risks in this too, that sometimes faster systems can be less dynamically stable and more volatile. You know, we see this to some extent in trading algorithms and trading AIs, and they can also, and I think this is a significant issue, contribute to greater anxiety and uncertainty amongst humans due to a speed mismatch. So we all have some sense, I think, of the world that's going too fast. This is sort of the thesis in, Alvin Toffler's famous book, The Future Shock, about an inability to keep up with changes. And I worry whether that would happen with the expedition of tasks to AI, that we feel just unable to do anything or unable to react appropriately to the advances in task resolution by AI. I mean, what do you say about that problem? Is that something that's worth taking seriously? Does it mitigate this positive case?
Yeah, I think it's worth taking seriously. I mean, I at least would like to see a world in which humans have a say over their lives and more generally over the direction of society. And it would be troubling if AI were to undermine that. So, I mean, there are a couple of ways I could respond to that. One is to, again, emphasize that the scope of this paper is about conditional optimism. And it might be that there are lots of ways in which we might not realize these benefits. But to take that point more seriously, I am not sure that it's inherent, because I'm not sure it's inherently the case that humans will feel left behind or are shut out of decision making, because there are lots of ways in which the tasks that are being expedited can be thought of at multiple levels of abstraction. So just take a computer example. I don't really feel left out right now by the fact that my computer is doing millions or billions of additions and multiplications per second, and I don't really care that I'm missing out on the details of that, because I'm able to participate in the sort of the more abstract processes and services that the computer is producing, which is being able to Skype with you and edit documents and things like that. So I think analogously, perhaps where humans aren't going to want or need to or be able to supervise all the low-level cognition that's going on in a bunch of fast AI systems, but they could still inject their high-level preferences into this dynamic where they say, "Oh well, we want to go to Mars, or we don't want to go to Mars," and I think it would be better for this to happen sooner rather than later. So I think there's a potential for sort of humans moving up the ladder of abstraction of tasks, but. Yeah, I think it's important that we think about not just individually, how do we keep humans in the loop of a single AI system, or do we want them to, but how do we think about these emergent dynamics of a bunch of AI systems interacting? And already, as you said, we're in a society where lots of decisions are being made by a bunch of different actors, and that can lead to bad consequences as a result. So the flash crash is a good example of what we might worry about in the future with AI. Some people have talked about flash wars, where autonomous systems and sensors sort of get out of control and lead to escalation in a manner that no one really wants. So these are serious concerns. I'm not sure that they're insurmountable, but it's definitely something I'd like to think about more.
Yeah, I mean, one analogy that I like, which I think underscores your point about moving up this ladder of cognitive abstraction, is that technology always effectively changes the cognitive landscape or the cognitive ecology in which humans operate. And this is true for, you know, very old or ancient technologies, such as like the technology of writing, that it changed the kinds of things that humans needed to do and that they could do, and they could redirect their energies and attentions within the new cognitive ecology. And I think the same point can be made about AI, but I guess the concern with AI is that if we do achieve general intelligence, there's going to be no new space within the cognitive ecology for humans to gravitate towards, or possibly no new space for them to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think that is I think it's possible to end up in a world where there's no new ground to be broken by humans that couldn't have been broken by AI systems. But that doesn't mean that there's no new ground. And so I think it's there's an infinite number of cognitive tasks, just like there's an infinite number of artworks to be written or produced. So I think it's possible to live in a world where humans aren't at the peak of the cognitive hierarchy, and yet they're still able to do things that have never been done before and think things that have never been thought before. It sort of depends how you frame the issue in terms of whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I personally think that we should move towards a world where, you know, what's unique and awesome about humans is that we're, we have a particular set of emotions and thought processes and histories that allows us to have good experiences and to do good things together. That we're not putting all of our self-value and collective value on based on intelligence. So, that might be scary to some people, but I think it's ultimately going to be a better future if we can get over the intelligence thing and instead focus on the experience side of things and being good people and having good lives.
Yeah, let's come back to that, because that actually features in heavily in the sure. final argument. But I accept the point that this notion that we'll have nowhere left to go is misleading insofar as there are, as you say, an infinite number of tasks.
Yep.
Yeah. So the second argument then in the paper, which has to do with the ways in which AI could improve coordination. Could you try and explain that argument for us? I mean, what's an example of a coordination problem that AI could help to solve?
Yeah, so generally speaking, I think that coordination and cooperation are super important for human affairs, and it's often failures of coordination have often been cited as reasons why we should have governments. So in a prisoner's dilemma, everyone would be better off if they cooperated, or the prisoners in this case who are being tempted to tell on each other, but they both should just keep their mouths shut, they would be better off if they cooperated with one another, but they individually are incentivized to defect. And so I think we often run into that as a society and between societies. And that's a reason why you should have things like law enforcement or international agreements or detailed treaties for with terms for verifying arms control agreements and things like that. And I think there are potentially two ways that AI could allow for better resolution of cooperation problems. And I think they both have a lot of limitations and risks associated with them. But I'll just briefly make the positive case for both of them. One is that AI could allow much better monitoring of behavior. So by that, I mean basically surveillance. And that is scary and has a lot of risks. But the upside of it is that a lot of things like arms control and violent crime are facilitated by a lack of monitoring. So things like criminals selling nuclear secrets to terrorists or to rogue states is something that in principle could be avoidable if you have surveillance cameras or drones everywhere, and they have AI, they have face recognition, and they have social network analysis and other features that are sufficiently sophisticated to detect, this is an ongoing violation of the non-proliferation treaty for X, Y, and Z technology, notify authorities and intervene in it. So the second So that's sort of the better monitoring argument. And this is something that's true both sort of observationally from looking at, this is how an arms control treaty didn't work out. And it's also true just theoretically, like in the game theory literature, people know that monitoring is important in order to incentivize good behavior. And the second argument is more about sort of removing humans from the decision-making loop and the upside of that. So like what we were talking about earlier, earlier, but the positive spin on that. And so an example I give in the paper is someone who's working at the NSA in the US, and they might be tempted to abuse their power for political reasons or for personal reasons, and say they like spy on their girlfriend or boyfriend. And that's obviously bad and something that we don't want to happen. And a way in which AI could prevent that, and you know, it could also make it worse if AI is just a tool for humans to do those things, but a way in which it could make it better is if the AI system, the surveillance system, was just an AI that had code that could be audited, and that it could, there could be strong guarantees that no human will ever actually see that surveillance data, and that it will only be processed in very well specified ways. More generally, I think you can remove aspects of human bias and corruption from surveillance systems and from government governance systems more generally. And by taking human bias and human idiosyncrasies out of government decision processes, you can potentially have more expansive governments and more invasive governments while avoiding some of the risks that have historically been associated with invasive cooperative systems. So that would sort of open up the door for things like international governance or global government, but without some of the downside risks that would be associated with it today, where you don't really trust that human to, you know, not use their global emperor status maliciously. Whereas in principle, for a safe AI system that was able to actually take on that task, you could be given strong guarantees based on auditing the code and formal verification and so forth that it would actually be doing the right thing.
Yeah, so I mean, this is one area where I think that the conditionality of your case for optimism bites quite hard, because it seems to me that a lot of those benefits of improved coordination are highly contingent upon solving problems around malicious use of AI or solving AI-related control problems. So just, I mean, I had two questions about this. One was, you know, aren't AI systems also likely to be used maliciously to circumvent or undermine existing coordination systems, regulatory systems? We have maybe some evidence of that already. I mean, one example that occurred to me, I don't know if you would classify it as an AI system, would be like the Volkswagen's way of cheating the admissions tests for their diesel engine cars. I mean, that seemed to rely on a fairly sophisticated algorithm that could detect various bits of input from the testing software. So maybe it was a use of AI to circumvent a regulatory system. I mean, is that not a problem that's likely to arise as well, that we'll use AI to exacerbate or worsen collective action problems?
Yeah, so I think that is a fair concern, and I've actually been thinking about the Volkswagen analogy in the context of AI recently, because it's currently the case that a lot of AI systems are not very interpretable, and there could potentially be all sorts of unintentional or intentional funny business going on in AI systems, and then someone claims that this AI system actually is, you know, the right thing to do for arms control reasons, and it's very safe, and there's actually some hidden agenda. So I think we're going to need progress in interpreting AI systems and verifying exactly what they are and aren't able to do in order to avoid that. So just to give one example, there was a paper presented at the NIPS 2017 conference that I was just at a few days ago. It's an AI conference, and the paper is called Bad Nets. And essentially what was going on there is that they showed that if you give someone your data in order to train an AI system, and then they give it back to you, there are all sorts of malicious ways in which they could have trained it in order to introduce a backdoor into the AI system that they ultimately give you. So they may give you a trained AI system that works, you know, really well, like it classifies 95% of the, you know, the test data correctly, and you think everything's great, and it's statistically indistinguishable from what you actually asked for, but when presented with a backdoor input, which is, you know, like a CAD or a stop sign or whatever, it will cause it to go haywire. So it sort of has like a vulnerability built into it as a result of the training process. So that's sort of, you know, the AI version of the Volkswagen problem. And it is, I would expect humans to try things like that. And I would expect humans to come up with all sorts of ways of using AI maliciously. And I, you know, don't have a clear solution to that. I think it's something where more technical work and more thinking around the governance implications is needed. So, yeah, I'm not convinced that we're going to be getting there anytime soon. But I think that over the long term, assuming that there is substantial investment in that area, and assuming that AI doesn't, you know, sneak up on us too quickly, and we have time to think through what role we want AI to have in society, then I think there's no in principle reason why you couldn't have really good verification of the properties of AI systems. Currently, there are sort of trade-offs with, you know, how interpretable can your system be on the one hand, and how much can you verify its behavior, and also like how high performance is the system on the other hand. But I think ultimately, if, you know, we're able to have better research, I think we should be able to have the best of both worlds. But, you know, we're not there yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, this might affect then how you answer the other question I had, which was probably not well formulated or well thought out. But I thought maybe there's a potential chicken and egg type problem with this argument around improved coordination, which was just that in order to develop AI in such a way that, you know, the control problem is solved, that it's not used or doesn't pose a severe existential threat to us and is not used towards malicious ends, we may well need to a global treaty on the safe development of AI. But given what we know about other similar agreements, like climate change agreements, for example, you know, it's very difficult to enforce and police those on a global level, and we may well need an effective, super powerful AI coordination system to enforce that agreement. But it seems like we're not going to get that effective, safe, and super powerful AI coordination agreement or system without the agreement in the first place. So, you know, there's some tension there.
Yeah, no, I definitely see your point. And I think that it's worth considering, you know, how much coordination do we actually need? And this is something that, you know, I don't have super settled views on, and I know people who think about these sorts of things who also disagree amongst each other. So, but I think it's, I mean, there are a couple things I should say. One is that it's not clear that you actually need, like, you know, super crazy global governance in order to realize some of these benefits. So it didn't take, you know, a non-proliferation treaty in order for, you know, the U.S. to build the Manhattan Project. And in principle, at that point, they could have given it over to the U.N. for, you know, U.N. control of atomic energy and set up a global monitoring system, you know, not with AI, but with human, you know, inspectors of uranium mining and nuclear processing and so forth. Sometimes you can, you know, in principle, you know, that's not exactly how things worked out, but one can take the first step and unilaterally provide some public good. And the second point is that it might not be a chicken and the egg problem, because it's not, you know, the chicken and the egg don't have to be fully formed. So what I mean by that is that you can have early versions of AI that help you sort of bootstrap to more effective governance. And I don't think you need to already have, you know, super intelligence in order to, you know, inspect for people, you know, hiding who are like, you know, running off with a, you know, 1,000 GPUs to set up an underground mine or something like that. I think that's potentially something you can solve with you know, today's techniques. So that's uncertain. I don't really know for sure, but I could imagine a scenario in which you know, narrow AI systems are used to set up the conditions for slightly more general ones and so forth. And there's sort of this ladder of incrementally having more and more trusted, more and more better governed AI systems.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of bootstrapping process sounds plausible to me to some extent, but I guess, yeah, the devil would be in the detail and how it works out in practice.
Absolutely.
Let's move on then to the final argument, which is this argument for the possibility of a leisure society. Now, this is something I've actually written about myself to some extent, but maybe you could explain your version of this argument.
So the idea that there could be a leisure society is not super novel, and people have been talking about it for a very long time, and predictions abound about how quickly such a society will come about through technological progress, or whether it's even a technological problem to begin with. And recently, some of my colleagues, for example, at the Future of Humanity Institute and elsewhere, did a survey of AI researchers who were published in the NIPS and ICML conferences. And there is a wide range of opinions on how soon it will be the case that AI systems can automate any human job. But I take it as a reasonable hypothesis that humans are just doing physical stuff in their heads, like brains are physical systems and in principle simulatable by other physical systems, and that eventually anything that's going on there can be automated. So if we end up in such a world eventually, then we would need to renegotiate what society looks like and who's doing what jobs. Is anyone doing any jobs, and how are the fruits of this society distributed? And one possible scenario, which I do not try and argue as the best one in the paper, because there were some page limits and so forth, and I'm not even positive that this is the correct view, but one possible scenario is that we have a basic income that's provided to everyone, possibly augmented with some other social welfare benefits, and people are not required to perform any tasks that they don't want. They just focus on art or science or reading or hanging out with friends and family or raising children. They do whatever they want, whether they think of it as work or leisure, but it's not actually required in order for them to survive or to have a high standard of living. And I think that society could be potentially very prosperous relative to the one we have today. So if one takes the my point earlier about scalable competence really seriously, then one could scale up pretty much any existing or plausible near-term standard of living to everyone in the world, especially if we get into space colonization, other things. So I think that that's definitely a society that's worth thinking about the ethical and social and economic aspects of, but I don't so I don't really argue that it's definitely going to happen. But I think the case, the argument for why AI is critical to this is that it's what sort of connects the wide distribution of the benefits of the society with the high degree of prosperity. So there have historically been societies on the backs of extreme income inequality or human slavery, where a small class of people were able to be aristocrats or slave owners and have, what from their point of view and like in historical perspective at the time seemed like pretty good standards of living, but it was in an unethical way. So I think in principle, AI and robotics applied to producing a lot of goods and services might be the most ethical way to have both wide distribution and high standards of living for everyone.
Yes, I think that's kind of the key part of the argument for me. There are lots of ways in which I think abolishing or eliminating work in the sense of paid employment could be a good thing, and obviating the economic need or necessity of work could be a good thing. But you have to solve the distributional problem and make sure that one person's leisure doesn't come at the expense of somebody else's servitude or slavery. So that's one reason to be optimistic about AI, is that it can provide a pathway or a route to a leisure society that doesn't rely upon that kind of exploitation of other human beings. And that's the argument that I would make in favor of it, for sure. But then I worry a little bit about the concept of a leisure society and what it is that people do in a leisure society, that often the utopian ideal of the leisure society is not well fleshed out. So it's sort of a similar problem to the one that motivates your paper, that people are optimistic about AI, but the actual mechanisms of optimism are not well specified. And I worry about the same thing is true sometimes for a leisure society. So just one illustration of this. The assumption in what you said was that once people have a leisure society, they'll just be able to kind of do whatever they want. There's no compulsion on them to do something out of economic need, so they can engage in whatever tasks they like scientific research or whatever. But actually, maybe scientific research won't be open to them anymore, or at least a meaningful kind of scientific research won't be open to them anymore, because all the hard scientific problems are turned over to machines, that they're the ones that are exploring space, working out the ultimate physical laws, ones that are curing disease. You know, maybe humans can play a game alongside it, but it won't have any ultimate significance or meaning. I mean, what do you say to that kind of concern about leisure?
Yeah, so you actually got me there. I didn't mean to mention science. So I originally had scientific research in my list of things in the paper, and then I took it out precisely for that reason, because I think, like, over the long term, it's not clear that research is necessarily the thing that people are going to spend their time on. I do agree that, yeah, as I was saying earlier, there's always going to be new tasks that one can do, even if anything that humans can do could in principle have already been done by an AI system. But I think that in scientific research, there's sort of a sense in which it's not just the novelty that matters, it's also the importance. So science is at least potentially an area that could asymptote in particular domains, where in AI, yes, like, one could apply AI to a new problem or a slight variant on a new problem. But if AI research is predominantly done by AIs, then one is not going to come up with, you know, the DQN algorithm or the A3C algorithm for the first time, or one is not going to be able to come up with a better algorithm than has already been thought about in, you know, the simulated equivalent of 100 million years of AI research being done by these systems. So I erred in mentioning that. I mean, there could be some counterargument to both what I just said and what you just said, but I take as given that scientific research isn't going to be the thing that humans spend their time on for millions and billions of years. But I do think things like art and learning what's already been learned both by humans and by machines, and playing games and raising children and spending times with people one likes, are potentially more sustainable as sources of leisure. So generally think that it's possible that we could have this society of leisure and human prosperity, and avoid sort of, you know, rampant depression or oppression, but it's not clear how to get there. And I think it's exactly as you said, that this is an area that's sort of mentioned glibly and deserves serious sustained analysis, especially if this is like what people are claiming is the end game for human civilization. But, you know, for the purpose of this paper, I did not try to, you know, make that definitive case.
Yeah. And actually, I happen to be working on a book on post-work utopianism at the moment, so some of these thoughts are in my head, and I haven't really worked out my own views on them as well as I would have liked at this point in time. I think we're heading up on an hour now, so I think we'll try and wrap up, but I wanted to maybe close with the question that we postponed from earlier on, which is, you know, the origin of this paper was in that EU Parliament presentation, discussion. I mean, once you presented these ideas there, what was the feedback or reception of them? Were people receptive or positive about them? What was it like?
Yeah, I mean, there was an interesting discussion. So, I mean, certainly not everyone had the same opinions. So Steven Pinker and Peter Benley, for example, were not super big fans of the existential risk or catastrophic risk perspective, which was, which I and Ollie Hogstrom were both more sympathetic to on this panel. But there were some good questions from the audience, and I did have some discussions with people afterwards who found it useful to have this this upside of AI vision fleshed out in more detail. And I'm hoping that that was just a few hundred people, and probably not many people watched the video online, and I'm hopeful that when this volume is published and when this podcast is published, which I think the volume part will happen next month, I think that my argument and Ollie Hogstrom's argument and a few other contributors who participated in the event and some who didn't participate in the event will reach a wider audience, and people can have a bit more meat to grapple with in terms of saying, am I optimistic or pessimistic about AI, and what exactly does that mean? But it's it's a long-term evolving conversation that a lot of people come with strong views on, and I'm hoping that I did my small part to foster more conversation.
Yeah, so I look forward to that that book when it arrives. So yeah, thanks for joining me for this conversation, Miles.
Thanks, John. It was a good conversation.